Good morning and welcome to the first CCTA podcast. This will be a series of regular discussions about the credit industry hosted by me, the Chief Executive of the CCTA, Greg Stevens. In the weeks and months to come, I will be exploring all aspects of the credit industry, from the supply of products and services to the impacts on technology, through to regulation and politics, and how these impact on credit businesses. For each podcast, I will be joined by a colourful cast of characters drawn from the credit industry, the law, politics, the media and consumer groups. Our guests will give us a full range of perspectives on our industry, enabling us to plan for the future with greater certainty. But for our first podcast, we're doing what everybody else seems to be doing at the moment, and we're talking politics. The general election is only a week away, so today we have an election special for you. And with me to discuss the state of the campaign, who is going to win, and what the implications will be for the credit industry are Patrick Diamond, lecturer in public policy at Queen Mary's University in London, and a former special advisor to both Tony Blair and Peter Mendelsohn, and James Forsyth, political editor of The Spectator magazine. Gentlemen, can I start with you, James, with regard to, in the days prior to the terror attack in Manchester, we'd seen a tightening in the polls, with some recording Theresa May's lead down into the single digits. What credence do you attach to these findings?
Well, the opinion polls obviously had a very bad general election in 2015. The polling industry said they've made some changes, but we can't actually be that much more confident that they are right this time round. So I think in some ways it is more sensible to rely on what people on the ground in these target seats for the Tories are saying on both sides. And what they are saying is, this election never felt like it was a 20-point Tory lead, but the Labour vote was a bit more resilient than that. But they say that at the moment, it doesn't feel like a 5-6-point race to them. I think the consensus is that if people had to put a number on it, they would say that the Tories are about 10 or 12 points ahead. But I think what is certainly true is this, is at the start of a campaign, it seemed that there was kind of almost no ceiling on the Tory vote. The Tories were polling at kind of 46, 49%. What's happened is that the Tory vote has stayed steady or very marginally declined. And what you've seen is the Labour vote rising, not off direct transfers from the Tories, but because they've squeezed the Labour bit of a UKIP vote, and they've got the Green vote coming to them, and they've also, the Liberal Democrats, have really failed to get going in this campaign. So I think a lot of people, including myself, thought that the Liberal Democrats would eat into the Labour vote a bit, especially amongst those more ideological pro-Europeans. That hasn't happened. So I think we are still looking at a fairly comfortable Tory majority. I think the question in Westminster is this, is that kind of the par score for Theresa May in this campaign is a majority of about 80 seats or so. Will she hit that or not is the big question. And I think at the moment, she probably will. But that will require her to close the campaign more strongly than she has during the campaign itself. You know, I think if you talk to Tory MPs, although they're not MPs at the moment, they're candidates, talk to them, they say the problem with this manifesto is that on the doorstep, there isn't very much of a retail offer. They can't say to people, vote Tories and get a tax cut. They can't say to people, vote Tory and get more money for this or more money for that. And overhanging the manifesto is what you might almost call a negative retail offer, which is this so-called dementia tax, which has really cut through with all voters, but particularly those voters the Tories need. You know, elderly voters, homeowners. And I think this is the challenge. Theresa May needs to get off that issue in the final weeks of a campaign and back onto what is her strongest suit, which is who do you want negotiating with Brussels, me or Jeremy Corbyn?
OK. Patrick.
Well, I think the polls do reflect some real movement in political support. And I think that reflects in part an expectations gap in the sense that when the campaign started, Jeremy Corbyn, I think it's fair to say, was clearly on the back foot and was expected to lose the election very heavily. His own personal ratings were in very negative territory. He was not perceived to be either an effective leader or, frankly, a capable figure to be prime minister. Whereas, of course, Theresa May was soaring in the polls. Her personal ratings were extremely strong. She had a lot of leadership credibility coming off the back of the decision to trigger Article 50 in March. Since then, though, there has been this, I think, somewhat surprising, unexpected narrowing in the position. I think to some extent, some of Theresa May's weaknesses have been exposed by the dynamic of the campaign. For example, she does seem to have some difficulty engaging with ordinary voters in a way that voters, at least on television, can perceive as being authentic and effective and so on. And Jeremy Corbyn isn't quite the demon that some people expected. I mean, he can utter a coherent sentence. He does seem capable to some degree of leading his party. He's created a certain team spirit. The Labour campaign has been more effective than some people expected, albeit with some problematic interviews from Diane Abbott and others. So I think all of that really speaks to an expectations game, which to some extent Labour has won. The Conservatives were never, as James has said, I think doing as well as the polls reflected back in March, April. But the position has narrowed. Having said all of that, will it make a fundamental difference to the result of the election in the end? I suspect not. I think one of the problems of looking at trends within election campaigns is that they can reflect movements which are the product of unexpected events. Obviously, Manchester last week has been extremely serious in terms of its impact on the campaign. They also reflect movements that reflect media and so on. I think to me, what really matters is what will happen in the final 72, 48 hours when voters really make up their minds, when they think about going into the polling booth, who they're going to vote for, who they want to be Prime Minister, who they want to handle the European negotiations. And then I would expect the Conservative position to strengthen. And therefore, I think the prediction of a Conservative majority of somewhere between 80 and 110 seats feels like the right kind of territory to me. Obviously, you can come back on June the 9th and tell me that I was very wrong.
I think Patrick is right that we, in politics, we tend to overstate the importance of campaigns, that most voters aren't paying as close attention to this as we are. And as Patrick said, they will make their call quite late in the day, and it will be about the kind of classic issues of who do you think the best person to be Prime Minister is, who do you think is best for me and my family, the economy. I think somewhere where campaigns do matter, though, is Westminster, which is in terms of the perception of these people within their own parties. Now, given that everyone is treating the result of this election as a foregone conclusion, that the Tories will win again, I think the campaign will matter in terms of what happens in Westminster after the election. I think the fact that Jeremy Corbyn has not had a disastrous campaign is going to embolden his allies in saying, look, let him have another go. You know, this is like, you know, Neil Kinnock sets a precedent for this. You know, you can lose an election but stay on as Labour leader. And I think they will try and argue that any progress that Labour makes during the campaign is proof that when the public get to hear from Jeremy, is what they, you can already hear the June the 9th, you know, at about 7 a.m. on the BBC, this being said by his supporters. When the public get to hear from Jeremy, that they come to him. So let's give him more time to close the gap. Look at the fact that he did better than Ed Miliband, they'll start saying, as if that is the kind of greatest electoral achievement for a Labour leader than doing better since Tony Blair, and doing better than Tony Blair. And I think for Theresa May, this campaign matters because she has an odd relationship with her parliamentary party. I don't think before this leadership contest, many people would have called themselves Mayites in the Tory parliamentary party. She won that contest because of a unique circumstances. You know, all the more fancy candidates had either been knocked out by the EU referendum result or took each other out, as Boris Johnson and Michael Gove did. And that left a hole in the crown. And I think lots of Tory MPs were frankly slightly perplexed by how popular she was. I had a very odd experience of people who were not fans of her saying, but she's really popular. They were kind of slightly didn't quite understand what was going on. And I think what this campaign has done, it has shone a light on some of the weaknesses of the May approach to politics. We saw at the start of a campaign the strength of this incredibly tight inner circle. But they managed to do something that in all my years covering politics I've never seen done before. They managed to call a general election and it be a genuine surprise to everyone, you know, including the cabinet. I mean, it was quite remarkable how tightly held it was. There was not a hint of it anywhere. That is the advantage of a closed circle. The problem with the closed circle is for social care policy that you got in the manifesto, that you suddenly launched into something that if you had asked more people about it, you might have had more people saying, hang on a second, I'm not sure how this is going to play. Do we really want to go into this general election campaign with the biggest policy in our manifesto as something that it appears to be aimed squarely at our own base? You know, is that really the sensible policy? Now, we know that Lyndon Crosby raised concerns about this. We also know, interestingly, that Fiona Hill, one of Theresa May's chief of staff, was less convinced of the policy. But the author of the policy, Nick Timothy, her other chief of staff, who is very influential, kind of pushed it through. And I think what we are seeing here is that after the general election, even if she comes back with a big majority, there will be grumblings from cabinet ministers that the way Number 10 operates has to change. Now, I don't think it will change, because I think the way Theresa May operates is the way that she feels she has to operate, that she survived at the Home Office doing this, and she is going to run Number 10 like this. But I don't think she will have the untrammeled authority that you would normally expect someone to have who has come back as Prime Minister of an increased majority. So that is one thing to watch post-election, I would say.
You've already mentioned with regard to the popularity of Theresa May on her index, and obviously the increase on Jeremy Corbyn's. Jeremy Corbyn has also been looking at soulless issues, whether it comes to care, whether it comes to tuition fees, whether it comes to the, if you like, the grey vote. On top of that, it's almost there are signs that he's actually winning over the Labour voters. So it's not a situation that, oh, it's Corbyn. Is he seen as being a potential leader in waiting? Do you think that the PM overreacted on the social care policy, or was that just a bad policy in the first place?
Well, as Winston Churchill said of sewers, I certainly wouldn't have dared start, but I certainly wouldn't have dared stop. I think you turning in the way she did during an election campaign was extremely risky. I also don't think she pulled off the U-turn with great elegance. The way to pull off a U-turn is to turn it into a virtue. I've listened. I understand your concerns. The last thing I want is more worry for people as they grow old. That is why I'm changing tack. Instead, she kind of tried to claim that nothing had happened, which I don't think was particularly effective, because I think it's so confusion in voters' minds, which is, are you getting rid of this policy, which I don't like, or not? And I think you saw that in the bank holiday Sky Channel 4 debate, when one of the questions from the audience didn't seem to kind of take into account the U-turn. The thing I would say about Jeremy Corbyn, which would be interesting to hear Patrick's views on, is that this campaign is in some ways a kind of Corbynite tribute to New Labour. The constant repetition of the many, not the few, talking about spending as investment in the future. You can always hear Gordon Brown when Jeremy Corbyn says this. He has not run quite as a kind of Corbynite candidate. He's tempered this and tried to sound more like a kind of classic New Labour politician. I was struck that on immigration last night, given his own personal views, he gave the kind of best answer he could have given, which is that he expects it to fall. He doesn't want wages undercut. He's going to bring back the migration impact fund, as if this was the answer to all problems. And he is doing a good job, I think, of presenting himself as a kind of more traditional Labour figure than what he is. He is far more outside of the mainstream of Labour thought, I think, than he is coming across as in this campaign.
So you had, when the manifesto was published, I think this quite strong narrative about the need to make tough choices and difficult decisions. I accept that this is not, you know, the stuff of retail politics in the sense of a sellable manifesto on the doorstep, but I think it's a fairly convincing pitch in a world where I think voters recognise there are tough choices ahead. The fiscal position is still difficult since the financial crisis. You know, no government can wave a magic wand. There are going to be some hard choices about public spending in the future. I think all of that was at the core of May's narrative and was, I think, an effective case that could have been made in the run-up to polling day. But I think having U-turned on the social care policy, she's obviously lost that narrative, but she's also undercut it, I think, quite badly. The event that actually it reminded me of most when she did the U-turn a few days after the manifesto was published was actually Gordon Brown's decision in 2007 not to hold a general election. After that decision, Gordon Brown was obviously interviewed on a number of broadcast outlets and asked why he changed his mind. And his answer was, frankly, very disingenuous. I mean, he said, well, I've just decided not to have an election now. Now's not the time, and so on and so forth. And I think the problem for May was when she made that U-turn decision, she sounded extremely disingenuous. She didn't sound genuine and authentic. And as I say, she really undercut what I see as one of her previous virtues, which is the ability to tell it how it is, to be tough, in contrast, frankly, to Labour, which looks like it's spraying public spending commitments around like confetti and not really facing up to difficult decisions.
I think one of the crucial things that our members are concerned about is obviously what will be the impact on business, what would be the impact on the economy. Obviously, Brexit is right in the middle of the agenda, but it does come back to people saying, will we be in a situation where through regulation, interference, is that going to be a problem? Certainly at the moment, CBI, the IOD, if anything, are very worried about the Conservatives in terms of the Conservatives being too anti-government, too anti-business, or appearing to be. Is that your view?
I think there's absolutely no doubt that Theresa May wants to shift where the Tory party is in terms of its relationship with business. And I think one of the other things that's going on is there's a structural shift caused by the seats the Tories are going after. A Tory party that after the election has MPs for places like Darlington, Stoke, some of the Welsh seats like Wrexham, that is going to be a Tory party that is inherently wants a larger state and is kind of more sceptical of business and the market. I think if you look at what defines Mayism, to the extent there is such a thing, it is that it is more sceptical, not only of business, but of the market than traditional Tory thinkings post-Thatcher. I think one of the really important things to remember about Theresa May is that she joined the Tory party before Margaret Thatcher became Prime Minister. And in some ways, she offers a kind of bridge back to that pre-Thatcher Tory party of Ted Heath and Harold Macmillan, with their views on, you know, corporatism, their views on kind of concern about untrammeled business power. Set against that, I would say, is the realities of Brexit. I mean, Brexit has structurally shifted British politics to the right because in the long run, I'm talking decades, not years, the only way that Britain can succeed as a post-Brexit economy is as a relatively light taxation, light regulation economy. You know, weirdly enough, the kind of the post-Brexit model of becoming kind of more European, more Christian Democrat in terms of both tax and regulation, I don't think is not actually sustainable in the long term, because that is not going to work for a Britain that is outside the single market. So I think I would say this, that there's obviously an immediate concern, which is that Theresa May is the most Christian Democratic leader of the Tory party we've had for 40 years. She's the most left-wing Tory leader we've had for 40 years. But then set against that on the other side is this structural shift that I think has occurred in politics because of the Brexit vote.
Patrick?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's always a distinction to be made between the rhetoric that a party uses in an election campaign and its manifesto and what it actually does in government. I would suspect that there will be quite a big significant gap between what the Conservatives have been saying in this campaign about market intervention and what will actually happen in government. Actually, two of the examples we've already talked about, both the decision to row back on changes in national insurance after the last budget, but also the decision to U-turn on social care policy, I think indicates to some extent that the May government is somewhat susceptible to pressure and lobbying from different interests. And I suspect that will be the case even after the election, not least because, as we've just heard, Brexit will, of course, be putting on a lot of pressure in terms of making the case that you're protecting jobs and that you're protecting the position of business in what will be a very uncertain, difficult environment. So although I think people might be concerned about what they're hearing from the Conservative manifesto, and as you said earlier, Steve, there are concerns among lobby groups like CBI and IOD, I suspect that in the policy outcomes will not be so different from what we've seen over the last 10 or 15 years. And as you say, I mean, the Labour manifesto is actually much more silent on these issues, which is, I think, also of interest. I think that the Jeremy Corbyn team is interested in some grand sort of nationalisations in areas like public utilities and rail, but actually is relatively cautious about intervening in other kinds of markets. And so, actually, whichever party gets into power, I wouldn't expect it to lead to, you know, big changes in policy outcomes in terms of regulation of the financial and consumer credit markets.
We've seen over the course of the last 6 months intervention in markets, and certainly the situation with regard to energy, and if you like, price capping. We've had price capping also imposed in one of the consumer credit sectors by the previous Chancellor George Osborne. Where do you think, or what do you think the government's position will be if it's a Conservative government? Do you think we could be seeing more intervention or less intervention?
I think we will see more intervention on the grounds that railing against the kind of unacceptable faces of capitalism strikes a massive chord with the public right now. And I think that one of the things that has changed since the financial crisis is that in the 80s, in the height of Thatcherism, you know, everyone on the kind of free enterprise side of the argument saw themselves as being on the same side now. That's not the case now. If you want to get people to really rail against banks at the moment, go and talk to small business owners. That coalition has fallen apart. And I think that means there is more of a political appetite for intervention than there was previously. I think if you look at the energy market, that is a kind of classic case. There is no political price to pay right now for suggesting that, you know, energy prices should be capped or this or that. And I mean, there is also the issue of people in some ways haven't quite come to terms with privatisation of the utilities. There is still a kind of instinctive suspicion of what those privatised companies are doing. I think on credit in particular, there is another question here, which is in the top of the Tory party, there is very little sympathy to companies that they perceive are lending to people who they think will not have the power to pay that back with ease. And I think because these create very emotional political cases, and because lots of MPs come across these in their surgeries, I think there is a definite feeling that some of these companies are the unacceptable faces of capitalism of today, and there is a kind of desire to clamp down on them. Now, there are obviously arguments against that, but I think that is where the politics of the situation is right now.
I think one issue we haven't discussed so far is, of course, who's Chancellor after the election, because obviously the Chancellor is extremely influential in these decisions. I think Philip Hammond has been a relatively reluctant market interventionist. There obviously have been signals that his position might be coming to an end. He might be replaced with another Chancellor. That would affect, I think, the appetite for within the government for policies which amounted to significant incursions into market freedom. I think that if you look at the Conservative manifesto, to me at any rate, there isn't evidence of or much sign of a really significant change in policy in that manifesto. I mean, they're talking about, for example, introducing clauses into the requirements of regulators to protect vulnerable consumers. That isn't really though a radical policy shift. That's been talked about for a long time. It's something that most regulators already take account of. It is true that the Conservatives have adopted a policy fairly close to Ed Miliband's policy on energy price capping. That does certainly indicate some impatience with the way that privatised energy companies behave. But it's also true that after the 1997 election, Labour introduced a radical policy, which was a windfall tax, of course, on the profits of privatised utilities. But it was a fairly one-off policy that didn't then lead to further, you know, radical incursions into markets. And I would suspect here the situation will be fairly similar. I don't see this as part of a long-term process in which the state is going to become radically more interventionist, or in which there's going to be, you know, a massive array of new regulations. But there are going to be clearly a few pressures in some areas. The other interesting point is, of course, the pressure within the Conservative Party. I mean, George Osborne has got himself a fairly influential platform as editor of the news, as editor of the Evening Standard, in a sense, to make the case for a more free market liberal conservatism. So those within the Conservative Party, like Nick Timothy, Theresa May's key policy advisor, who want to shift in this more corporatist anti-market direction, are going to face some significant opposition. And I think in this climate, in this world post-Brexit, where people are thinking about Britain's competitive position, clearly a more free market, less interventionist, smaller government model is going to have a lot of currency within the Conservative Party. So, you know, again, whether Theresa May can really push these ideas in the long term, I would be very sceptical.
Your members should watch, this might sound an odd thing to say, they should watch the inflation rate, because I think that is going to play a huge, have a huge effect on what happens in terms of his interfering in markets. If the cost of living, in inverted commas, becomes the big political issue because inflation is outstripping wages, that will push the government, I think, in a more market interventionist way. These little interventions to reduce the price of kind of everyday staples, so energy prices, maybe water next, you know, potentially food, although the supermarket sector does seem to be slightly more competitive in terms of keeping prices down. All of those things will start to apply, and that obviously will have a knock-on effect on the kind of consumer credit sector.
Sorry, I just want to add one other very quick point, which is that perhaps we haven't sufficiently reflected in this discussion just how all-consuming the Brexit negotiations will be for the next 2 or 3 years, and that's if it goes successfully. Even if it does go successfully, you know, you're going to see 2 or 3 years in which Brexit is by far and away the dominant issue that the government is having to deal with in terms of its capability, the job of its ministers, what the civil service is doing, what Whitehall is consumed by. And so I think to expect a great flurry of new initiatives in other areas, whether they're regulatory initiatives or moves to try to intervene more aggressively in certain consumer markets, again, I have my doubts about that. I think we'll find in the next 5 years that Brexit is going to consume a huge amount of political oxygen, and I'm not sure whether there'll be much energy or scope elsewhere in government for other kinds of policy measures.
Patrick, so what do you think the shape of the Conservative government will be, or the incoming government will be?
Well, I think in terms of Parliament, it obviously depends on the election outcome. If Labour polls under 170, 160 seats, then the Labour parliamentary party that returns to Westminster is going to be, by any historical standard, a very left-wing Labour party. And that will have an effect in terms of political debate. It will create something of a dynamic, perhaps, to for some shift to the left. In terms of the Conservative government, the consolation of it, obviously James is much better placed to speak to that than I am. It's clear from the campaign there have been some quite heavy hints there could be major changes at the top of the government. I think the other factor we should just watch out for as well, of course, is the presence of the SNP. How well are they going to do in this election? I think the parliament we've just had, it's been interesting how a significant SNP presence has shaped the dynamic of Westminster debate. And if they lose seats, will we see a return to a more traditional Conservative Labour sort of battle? Those seem to me to be some of the big questions.
James?
I think the thing in Parliament to watch is the Great Repeal Bill, which is obviously they have to take through all this stuff, putting all this EU law into British law. I think watch that, because that, well, the very interesting question there is it just going to be as straightforward as it could possibly be given its complexity, you know, transposition? Or are you going to see people starting to say, hang on a second, the Clinical Trials Directive, right? If we were to tweak that, we would make ourselves a more attractive place for medical research than the rest of the EU. And that would compensate for any disinclination people had to come here because of Brexit or to move research labs. You know, are you going to see people saying, look, why don't we change the rules around data and privacy? Because that will make us a more attractive place for tech companies to come. So I think, and that is going to be in some ways also the proxy for the debate in the Tory party. The Tory party, I think, for the last 30 years, we've looked at every, people like me who are tragic enough to examine kind of every Tory selection in every seat. You look to see where that person stands on the Europe spectrum. I think that is no longer the most useful thing to do. The most useful thing to look is where do they stand on the question of the economy. How interventionist are they? How free market are they? And I think in the Great Repeal Bill, we're going to see an interesting example of this. Is the Great Repeal Bill just going to simply transpose all these things across, or is it going to indicate the different regulatory route that the UK intends to take in the post-Brexit era?
Talking about intervention, obviously the banks are a major part of the UK economy and impacts dramatically on GDP. Do you see a situation of an incoming parliament, Conservative government, interfering with the banks to the same degree or lesser degree?
Again, I'd be sceptical. I think if there's an egregious case of where a bank behaves, at least as far as the public are concerned, in a way which, you know, offends sort of basic sense of decency and fairness, i.e. that there are very large profits or very large bonus payments to executives that don't seem to be justified, or, you know, cases in which the welfare of the consumer seems to have been abused. And, of course, there's a possibility you could see action by government. But I think the broader context, of course, as we've discussed, is Brexit. I think the government will rightly be concerned about what financial services are going to do in a post-Brexit environment. Personally, I'm not as negative as some people are about what will happen long-term to financial services. I think the UK still remains a very attractive base. It's not clear at the moment whether activity is really going to shift to Paris or Frankfurt. There are many different obstacles and reasons why that may not be the case. But if the UK is going to continue to be attractive, and of course the City of London in particular, to the financial services sector, then that really requires government to retain a relatively light touch regulatory regime, and I think to play the politics more carefully perhaps than George Osborne did in the period when he was Chancellor. So again, I would be somewhat sceptical about whether we're going to see big moves by government which would be seen to damage the interests of banks and potentially to lead to the shift of activity from the UK to other jurisdictions, whether in the EU or elsewhere.
Brexit has shifted the power dynamic between governments and banks. You know, in the pre-Brexit era, you know, the bankers, you could tar and feather bankers, and where were they going to go? It's a different world now, because you've not only got Brexit, and this absolutely imperative for the UK economy that you keep London as the major financial centre in Europe and the major financial centre in the world. You add on top of Brexit the fact that you have the Trump administration in the United States and a Republican-controlled Congress, which might well be prepared to dramatically cut US corporation tax, might be prepared to change lots of the Sarbanes-Oxley regulation that drove lots of banks and financial activity to London. So I think you will see the banks, in terms of their kind of global operations, given a relatively free hand. I think, you know, the bank surcharge and all those kind of things, I think, are likely to go. Where I think you'll see a different attitude is probably more on the consumer-facing side. I think there will be probably more concern about, you know, making it easier for people to switch bank accounts, all of that kind of consumer agenda stuff. But I think on the high-level regulation stuff, and the imperative of keeping London as a global financial centre is going to overpower everything else. And I'd also say this, which is you can talk in lots of ways about making Brexit a success, to borrow Theresa May's phrase. I think ultimately one of the more obvious ways in which to do that is to use Brexit as an opportunity to actually increase London's global reach as a financial centre. And I think that is doable, but that is not doable at the same time as increasing regulation on banks, increasing the taxation on them.
I think the only point to watch for your members, particularly those who have strong association with the banking industry, is about also regional rebalancing. I mean, we've talked a bit about the UK and Europe. I think in a sense, though, one of the biggest issues for the banks is, you know, are they part of an economy which is structurally very heavily weighted towards London and the southeast of England, and which means that other regions, particularly the northeast and northwest, some of the former industrial areas in Scotland and Wales, frankly, in the last 20 or 30 years, haven't had their fair share of the economic pie. The perception is that that's one of the factors that led to, of course, the Brexit outcome. So I think for the banks, in terms of their public legitimacy and credibility, one of the factors they do have to watch a bit is, you know, can they be more positive contributors towards this rebalancing story in terms of business lending, encouraging industrial development outside the southeast of England, encouraging the growth of industries in parts of the UK which have not seen very strong rates of growth since the 1970s.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. We'll get together on June the 9th and see where we are. Thank you.